Hundreds of pagers used by Hezbollah exploded, killing 9 and injuring thousands.
Well, this is a pretty sophisticated intelligence operation. I have little doubt that this was a clandestine operation undertaken by the Israelis.
Mali says its capital is under control following an insurgent attack.
In a statement, the army said mopping up operations are underway.
And NASA is launching a probe to the Jupiter moon Europa.
Given everything that we've really learned about necessary conditions for life, Clipper is going to tell us if Europa has all of these ingredients for life.
Today is Wednesday, September 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
You know, it's somewhat surprising that Hezbollah would rely on pagers, knowing that Israel has a history going back decades of being able to detonate electronic devices.
At least 9 people were killed and about 2,800 wounded when hundreds of pagers belonging to members of Hezbollah exploded on Tuesday. Among the injured was the Iranian ambassador to Lebanon. Hezbollah has blamed Israel. Israel has not officially commented. We get details on the attack now in this report from Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman.
Security camera footage of a market in Beirut captures this moment on Tuesday. Something explodes, seemingly from inside one person's pocket or bag, and the man falls to the floor crying in pain. Lebanon's health minister said blasts like these killed at least 8 people and injured more than 2,800 across the country, many of them fighters and medics from the militant Islamist group Hezbollah. The pagers they used to communicate exploded. The pagers began to detonate around 3:45 p.m. local time, and explosions continued for an hour. It was not immediately clear how the devices were detonated. A Hezbollah official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said the detonation of the pagers was, quote, the biggest security breach the group had been subjected to in nearly a year of war with Israel. The Israeli military declined to comment on Reuters' inquiries about the blasts. Israel and Iran-backed Hezbollah have been engaged in cross-border warfare since the Gaza war erupted last October, the worst escalation in years. Iran's Meher news agency said the Iranian ambassador to Lebanon, Mojtaba Amani, was injured by one of the pager explosions. A senior Hezbollah source told Reuters the group's leader, Saeed Hassan Nasrallah, was not harmed. At one hospital, a Reuters reporter saw motorcycles rushing to the emergency room where people with their hands bloodied were screaming in pain. The head of a public hospital in the south of the country told Reuters that around 40 wounded people were being treated at his facility. The wounds included injuries to the face, eyes, and limbs.
Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman joining us now to give us some insight into all of this is Michael Domino with Defense Priorities. He's a former CIA military analyst and counterterrorism officer with expertise in the Middle East. So thanks so much for joining us to talk about this.
Absolutely, Scott. It's good to be with you.
So let's go big picture first. Tell us your initial thoughts when you heard the news.
Well, this is a pretty sophisticated intelligence operation. I have little doubt that this was a clandestine operation undertaken by the Israelis. Again, I don't think that we're going to see extensive confirmation of that, you know, in media or in any kind of government statement. But I think that the timing is really notable to me. I mean, you've seen sort of increasing talk and rumors and discussion of potentially a Israeli incursion into southern Lebanon on the ground to try to push Hezbollah north of the Litani River. And now you have this event, which I think took Hezbollah by surprise, certainly. And it also appears the U.S. government was not aware of. So I think, again, we're back in a situation here where things appear to be escalating across the region.
Let's talk about the attack specific. So the allegation is, and I've seen video, I just watched one a few minutes ago where so this guy's standing in a grocery store next to some fruit, and you can see the explosion on his hip. And he falls on the ground and he starts screaming. And so these pagers exploded, and a lot of them, hundreds of them, almost simultaneously. It actually was apparently stretched out of over an hour or two, but that's virtually simultaneously. So let's talk about that, the device, the pagers exploding.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is sort of, you know, something that the Israelis have done before. It's a classic sabotage operation, right? You try to identify the types of devices that your adversary might be using, in this case, this, you know, very specific brand of pager, and then get your hands on those devices, modify them, right, by adding some sort of plastic explosive. But again, they would otherwise function just like any other device, right? They would actually work to you know, take calls, and they would feel the same, they would look the same, they would be the same weight, right? And then you feed these devices back into you know, the known Hezbollah supply chains where they're sourcing this communications equipment from, and then you basically have a you know, a backdoor to do something like this very suddenly if you want to. And so I think the sophistication of the operation really has to be noted here. Again, there's sort of a separate discussion about, you know, the impacts of it or whatever, but the sheer thoroughness of what the Israelis have done here with penetrating this supply chain, you know, finding the right material for all of this, getting it back into the hands of Hezbollah after modifying it, Hezbollah's failure to actually do the operational security measures needed to, you know, check these devices, take them apart, make sure they're not being, you know, compromised either with listening devices or in this case, explosives. They didn't do any of that. And so this enabled, I think, a pretty remarkable day, just speaking of the operation itself.
I mean, these things aren't made in this part of the world. So at some point in time, they either had to buy a bunch of them or go directly to the manufacturers. I mean, you know, I mean, they obviously knew what kind of pagers and how to get them into the hands of the Hezbollah operatives.
Right. And that's the thing. I think people are misunderstanding, you know, okay, well, you know, was the manufacturer involved or something like that? And I don't think that's the case at all, right? It's more that the Israelis potentially through cutouts or front companies, right, may have purchased a large number of these, taken them back into, you know, Mossad labs, taken them apart, added these, you know, plastic explosives with some kind of detonator pin or something similar. And then, you know, maybe through a human source, they were able to, or a provider for Hezbollah's, you know, communications equipment, sell those, you know, pagers second or third hand back to Hezbollah, right? So it's a full spectrum operation where they have to understand, you know, the front end of where, of how Hezbollah is procuring their equipment and who is doing it and what kind of stuff they're buying. Then also on the back end, you know, actually doing the modification and compromising the devices in this way.
The other weird thing about this story, I read an article where Hezbollah actually announced publicly that they were getting rid of their cell phones and going to pagers so that they couldn't, their conversations couldn't be intercepted and they couldn't be found through GPS.
Right.
You probably shouldn't make that kind of announcement.
I would agree with you. And as someone that has worked on intelligence operations and spent a lot of time in the intelligence world, I just find the entire thing, frankly, baffling as far as Hezbollah's own communication security and operational security. I mean, this is just completely unacceptable. And one thing I think is important is, you know, state actors have a lot of resources at their disposal to maintain a high degree of operational security. Non-state actors, terrorist groups, there's more of a drain on your manpower and your time to enforce very strict standards with a lot of this stuff. And it doesn't appear that Hezbollah is doing any of that. And I think, yes, this sort of announcement that, well, cell phones are too vulnerable, so now we're going to go to pagers, just makes pagers the target, right? It doesn't actually absolve you of any of the issues with cell phones as far as, you know, penetration or those being compromised as well. So it's really just, you know, you're switching in six of one for half dozen of another. And, you know, the Israeli intelligence services are very capable at exploiting any of those devices, as we've seen.
Hmm. Mike, thanks so much for the info and the time.
Absolutely. Thanks, Scott.
Michael Domino with Defense Priorities. Hezbollah is part of Iran's web of proxies. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, Iran's threatening behavior toward the United States and its ally, Israel, is one of only a few foreign policy issues addressed by U.S. presidential rivals Kamala Harris and Donald Trump in the election campaign. VOA's Michael Lippin looks at the differing approaches of Harris and Trump in facing the threat from Iran and its proxies.
Democratic presidential nominee and Vice President Kamala Harris has focused her relatively brief remarks about Iran on one concept, defense.
And know this, I will never hesitate to take whatever action is necessary to defend our forces and our interests against Iran and Iran-backed terrorists.
In her debate with her Republican rival, former President Donald Trump, she pledged to extend that defensive approach to Israel, saying, "I will always give Israel the ability to defend itself, in particular as it relates to Iran and any threat that Iran and its proxies pose to Israel." The Biden-Harris administration helped Israel defend itself against an unprecedented aerial assault by Iran in April. It also sent warships to the region last month to deter Iran from doing so again, emphasizing that defensive approach could endear Harris to some Americans, says Michael O'Hanlon, Foreign Policy Research Director at the Brookings Institution.
I think that she knows Americans are tired of war and certainly doesn't want to sound like she's looking for another. And so who can be against defense, right? But Americans are wary about offense. So perhaps that can be part of it, especially given the history of the last quarter century.
But the Biden-Harris administration also saw Iran's proxies escalate their aggression in August, striking U.S. bases in Iraq and Syria, and executing a U.S. hostage in Gaza. Victoria Coates, Vice President for National Security at the Heritage Foundation, says those incidents highlight a weakness in the U.S. strategy.
There has been zero retaliation from the United States. They've retained that defensive posture. My worry is that Iran is getting the message that they can continue to provoke and to escalate on their terms, and all the United States will do is respond, not take the initiative.
Trump is emphasizing his record of sanctioning Iran for its malign behavior when he was president.
I told China and other countries, if you buy from Iran, we will not let you do any business in this country, and we will put tariffs on every product you do send in of 100% or more.
In the debate, he accused the Biden-Harris administration of enriching Iran and its proxies by easing that pressure. He also promised to resolve the Iran threat, but did not elaborate, saying, "Look at what's going on in the Middle East. I will get that settled and fast." During his term, Trump engaged in a two-year-long maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Trump's avoidance of recommitting to that strategy gives him the option of pursuing a new policy that pressures Iran more quickly. One similarity between Harris and Trump is that neither of them says what they will do if Iran makes a nuclear bomb, a prospect that Iranian officials have hinted at. Michael Lippin, VOA News, Washington.
Following these other stories from around the world, Air France is suspending service from the French capital's Charles de Gaulle Airport to Beirut and Tel Aviv until Friday because of escalating security concerns in the Middle East, according to the airline on Tuesday. North Korea fired multiple short-range ballistic missiles on Wednesday. Both South Korea and Japan followed the missile launches. It's just days after North Korea unveiled a uranium enrichment facility and vowed to beef up its nuclear arsenal. State media in Myanmar reported that floods and landslides triggered by last week's Typhoon Yagi have claimed at least 226 lives, 77 people still missing, So these new figures push the total number of dead in Southeast Asia from the storm past 500. Yagi earlier hit Vietnam, northern Thailand, and Laos, killing about 346 people in those countries. Ghana's main opposition, National Democratic Congress Party, on Tuesday held nationwide protests against alleged voter roll irregularities, demanding an independent forensic analysis and audit to rid the register of errors for free and fair elections.
When I go to my polling station and I show my voter's ID, they will not tell me that my name is not in that particular polling station, but my name is elsewhere, somewhere in Dodowa, and that I should go to Dodowa and go and vote there. That is the reason why we are calling for a forensic audit.
Voters in Ghana will head to the polls on December 7th to elect a successor to President Nana Akufo-Addo, who stepped down in January after serving the constitutionally mandated 8 years. Mali said on Tuesday that its capital, Bamako, was under control after insurgents attacked a school and other strategic areas before dawn, firing gunshots that reverberated around the city. Reuters correspondent David Doyle has the latest.
Mali said on Tuesday that the capital, Bamako, was under control after an attack by insurgents on a gendarmerie training school and other areas of the city. In a statement, the army said mopping up operations are underway. The national broadcaster told Malians that search and rescue operations were taking place, that the situation was under control, and to remain calm and follow the instructions of the security forces. Footage showed a mob burning what was said to be the remains of one of the suspected assailants. Mali is one of several West African countries fighting a jihadist insurgency in the Sahel. Thousands in the region have been killed and millions displaced as the militants have advanced and amid military efforts to push them back. Both governments and insurgents, some of whom have links to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State, have been accused of violence against civilians. Frustration with authorities' inability to restore order has contributed to two coups in Mali, as well as military takeovers in neighbouring Burkina Faso and Niger. But jihadist attacks have escalated despite the junta's promises to improve security. It is, however, rare for insurgents to strike inside the capital.
Reuters correspondent David Doyle. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Germany began implementing checks on all of its land borders as the government tries to crack down on irregular migration. But as we hear in this report from Henry Ridgewell, many of its neighbors, Germany's neighbors, have criticized the plan, which they say undermines the core European principle of freedom of movement.
German police and border guards began making spot checks on people arriving across all the country's land borders. Germany is part of Europe's passport-free Schengen zone. Its members can introduce border checks if there is a serious threat to public policy or internal security. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said the move was necessary.
The number of those who come to Germany irregularly is too large.
Germany took in more than 1 million migrants in 2015 in the wake of the Arab Spring. It is also hosting more than 1 million Ukrainian refugees. The influx prompted a backlash from some voters who have turned to the far-right Alternative for Germany party, which scored a shock victory in recent regional elections. Many of Germany's neighbours have reacted with anger to the border checks, including Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk.
I have no doubt that it is the internal political situation in Germany that is causing these steps to be implemented.
The border checks could undermine European unity in the long term, says analyst Raphael Bossong.
It could sort of aggravate a trend of mutual recriminations, rise of hard right and seriously Eurosceptic countries.
Germany is also stepping up the return of failed asylum seekers. Will the crackdown impact immigration? It's a complex issue, says Bossong.
We're not dealing with, you know, parcels or containers. We're dealing with people.
Meanwhile, a government official recently said that Germany could seek to strike a deal with Rwanda to send asylum seekers there for processing. Britain abandoned a similar plan in July. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
Here's a problem faced by many giant cities around the world. How to tamp down on the traffic that chokes their streets? In London, Oxford Street is home to some of the British capital's most famous shops, and its mayor says he wants to make it pedestrian only, shutting out the cars and buses. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino tells us how that would work.
London Mayor Sadiq Khan said the plan is to get rid of all traffic, including bikes, along the one-mile stretch from Oxford Circus to Marble Arch. The idea is to attract more shoppers. If the plan is approved, Oxford Street would become like other major traffic-free shopping hubs, like Times Square in New York and La Rambla in Barcelona. A previous version of the plan was blocked by the local Westminster City Council. But Khan says this time is different.
I've got the support of central government just to make sure Oxford Street, does well for decades to come.
His office says Oxford Street attracts about 500,000 visitors a day. But many flagship stores have shut down in recent years. They've struggled to recover since the pandemic. Some retailers welcome the move, like John Lewis. Its flagship store has been on Oxford Street since 1864. Others aren't so keen.
Terrible. I think it's a terrible idea. you need buses, don't you? How are you going to get from one end to the other? Crazy idea.
The plan needs final approval from Britain's Deputy Prime Minister. Prime Minister Keir Starmer's Labour Party has said it wants to accelerate the process of approving projects to speed up Britain's economic growth.
Reuters correspondent Olivia Zolino reporting. And finally,
Clipper is going to tell us if Europa has all of these ingredients for life.
Clipper is Europa Clipper, a NASA probe. Europa is one of Jupiter's moons. Europa Clipper is set to lift off next month on a SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket from NASA's Kennedy Space Center in Florida. The main aim is to determine whether Europa potentially has the ingredients necessary for life. It's NASA's largest ever planetary spacecraft.
Our mission does flybys of Europa, but is actually in orbit around Jupiter. And so for the primary mission, we do 49 flybys, but in the end, we end up orbiting Jupiter 80 times.
Okay, so they've been planning this for a long time. And on top of that, it takes a really long time to get to Jupiter.
We scientists have been dreaming about a mission like Europa Clipper for more than 20 years. We've been working to build it for 10 years. It's going to be another 10 years because Jupiter's so far away. And I'm really proud that as humanity that we choose to undertake these difficult and long-term goals, things like exploring the unknown out of Jupiter.
That's Lori Leshin, director of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Jupiter is more than 755 million kilometers from the sun. So that was a challenge for NASA.
We had to build these giant solar panels to capture the small amount of sunlight at Jupiter to power the spacecraft.
Jordan Evans, project manager, Europa Clipper. And we do have time for his Europa joke.
And to be clear, we're not landing on Europa. Make no attempt to land there.
It's a reference to the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey. It's pretty funny. All right, that's my geek moment for the show. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.